Today's episode is my interview with Dr. Lottie Valentine, and she is a physician, but also an intuitive healer, and she didn't get her medical degree or license until she was 58 or 59, or so. She started med school at 54, so yeah, and quite an amazing story. And she had to do a lot of classes because she was a business major in her undergrad many, many years prior, before having three kids and kind of living a completely different type of life. And so she had to go back and like take biology courses, basic college courses before she could even apply to med school. So she was really committed and dedicated. But when you find out why she did this, it is worth the listen. It is crazy. So she's had two near-death experiences. And she was, what she says, was an atheist before these experiences. And these experiences led her to connect to, you know, her spiritual world. It opened up a whole spiritual side of her. And she has become a medium, really. If, you know, she calls it, there's different Clairs. It's like clairvoyant, what does she call it? Clairaudient and clairsentient. And so she can see, she can hear, she can feel. And it's, you know, really a gift. But as she says, it's a gift we all have. And we just aren't sometimes connected to it because of the way we live our lives. We just aren't aware of the magic that exists. And so I hope you enjoy this episode. She is fascinating, and she's going to come back. We're going to have more to talk about. And I knew that it would be juicy. So yeah, take a listen.
Hi, I'm Laurie Wright, also known as Not Your Average Grandma. I created this podcast as a place to go for midlife inspiration. If you are in a stage where you believe the best is behind you, it is my hope that one of these episodes will ignite a long suppressed or unrealized desire, and you will see the potential within yourself just waiting to be tapped so you can do amazing things with the time you have left. I want you to stop seeing your age as a limitation and start seeing it as your superpower. You have years of experience and value that a younger you never had, so it's time to lean into that and use it to fuel your future. No more letting age hold you back from the pursuit of a more passion-filled life. The more passionate we are, the better the world will be. So stop settling for average, put your AirPods in, and let this episode inspire you to take the first step in transforming your mind, body, and soul.
Welcome to another episode of Not Your Average Lives. And today's guest is Dr. Lottie Valentine. And I am so excited. Oh my God. We are going to have so much fun talking about some juicy stuff. She calls herself the intuitive physician. And I love her story because she is somebody who started something brand new over the age of 50. So I think it's going to be really inspiring to hear her story about how she completely changed. She told me before I hit record that she was a computer programmer analyst at IBM when she got out of college. So yeah. And she became a doctor at, would you, a lot, Dr. Lottie, did you say
54? I went to medical school at the age of 54.
You went to medical school.
So started the medical school at 54.
Wow. That is crazy. So let's start there. What did you, and she also is a book author. So we'll talk about all the things. And of course, in the show notes, there is links to her social media and her website. But let's get to like what caused you to completely, and what were you doing at the time that made you feel this calling to something else that was different, so different?
Right. Quite a long transition phase. But let me back up just a little bit. So I was raised in Europe, in Northern Europe, in Sweden, and my father was a physician, a general practitioner, so worked in family medicine, and I was the fourth kid, so I had three older brothers, and when I was 12, my mom went back to school and finished her high school diploma first, because she got pregnant when she was, I think she had my brother when she was 18 or 19. And it was right, you know, during World War II. My father was in medical school. And so she had to drop out of high school. She was the only girl also in her high school class. It was way different back then. So anyway, I grew up always wanting to be a doctor. And my father would always say, you don't want to be a doctor. It takes too long. It's, you know, you want to get married. You want to have children. I was born 1958, right? So I was raised during the 1960s. It was so different back then. And I...
Aren't parents great?
Right. I ended up not...
Don't do what you love.
I ended up not listening to my heart, listening to my brain, which is what we do a lot in life. And so I majored in high school. I majored in languages and business. Then I met an American, married an American, moved to the United States. Then I went to Boston University. And again, my husband, then he was finishing his senior year. So he finished his year and then I went. And again, I said, oh, should I do the sciences? Should I go? Maybe my dad was right. Maybe I should do nursing. But I was too afraid of doing the science classes because English was such a barrier. I walked around that college campus with a dictionary around my arm, and I would go to the classes and write down phonetically what the teacher said, not understanding the words that he used. And then I would go home to my husband and his best friend, and I said, this is my homework. And I would pronounce what I had written phonetically, and they would look at me and say, yeah, what's the problem? Just do the homework. And I'm like, I don't understand what I'm saying. What are the words mean that I'm using? So imagine the obstacle. So
did anyway, your husband speak Swedish?
Yeah, he learned Swedish in Sweden. Yeah. So he spoke Swedish. And then I was, you know, we learn English in school over there, but it's a conversational English. You know, Uncle Roger took the train to London to have a cup of tea with, you know,
right,
with his best friend. So the going into, you know, college courses, you don't understand any of the words because those are not words that you use in a language class. So again, I majored in business and computer science, and that's how I ended up working for IBM as a computer programmer in my youth. So granted, I was very logical. I was an atheist. I didn't believe in the spirit world or religion. Everything was black and white for me. You know, you die, everything is black. And the programming was very systematic, right? So A leads to B leads to C leads to D.
And I was let me ask you there, because, you know, we talked, you know, before we started recording that my dad and my mom were that way. And so were you raised? We weren't really raised with religion. And actually my aunt was like off the charts kind of crazy at one point in her life. And so I think it turned them away from religion, you know, even more so, because they were raised with religion, as a lot of people were when that day and age in the 30s and the 40s. Mm-hmm. So were you not exposed to religion as a child?
So my dad was born 1918, and so he would always tell us how ever since he was 3 years old, so 1921, he had to go to Sunday school, like his whole childhood. He knew the Bible inside out. He served on the committee at the church. Did we ever go to church? No. Sweden, everybody's a Lutheran, and I was confirmed when I was 14, didn't believe in anything they taught me. So I did have exposure to religion. Right. And back in the 1960s, when I went to school, the state and the church had not yet separated. So we actually sang psalms, and the teacher would play the organ every morning, and we would stand up, and it was very different. And then somewhere along the line, when I was probably a teenager, I think they separated the state and the church. So, but then I majored in the wrong thing, to go back to the original story. And so I worked for IBM in my youth, and then I started having kids. And after that third child, I hemorrhaged to death in the ER, which then led me to have my first near-death experience. And so that first experience, I'm lying on the table. It's the fifth time I'm hemorrhaging in 3 days. Blood clots the size of a baby's head, just enormous. And as I'm dying, this is very different because I knew I was dying, because my daughter was born between a 7.4 earthquake and a 7.2 earthquake. So as I was giving birth, I had one of those experiences that I think many people have when you're almost in a car accident, your life flashes before your eyes and you're like, oh my gosh, this is it. I'm going to die. And then somehow, you know, you get out of that pickle. So I had that experience. Once during her birth, because it was a 7.4 earthquake, my labor.
Yeah, so where was that? Where was that earthquake?
That was, it was centered in the desert just east of Anaheim in Southern California.
Oh, wow.
The reason it was actually a bigger earthquake than the Northridge earthquake that caused a lot of damage, but it's because the center was in the desert. But I was in the eastern part of Anaheim, so like pretty much the last town before the desert. So where we were, the hospital. It was also built on rollers. This really shook back and forth, this swayed back and forth. All the instruments on the trays in the labor unit, you know how they have all these metal utensils, right, on the metal trays, they were levitating up and down, like you're banging knives and forks, you know, that kind of sound on a metal counter. And we lost all the power and my labor stopped. And then I hemorrhaged. That was the first time I hemorrhaged, was after I gave birth, but then I gave birth and then we had a 7.2 earthquake and then I hemorrhaged. So then they kept me in the hospital for another 2 days and gave me a Pitocin drop. And then 10 days after the birth, I hemorrhaged, went to the ER, got sent home, hemorrhaged again, called the hospital. They said, see the doctor tomorrow morning, saw the doctor, no tests, no ultrasounds. And then I hemorrhaged again, went back to the ER and then hemorrhaged again in the ER. And just luckily, this nurse just randomly decided to check on me and realized how much I was bleeding. And then as they're calling all the people into the room, they're tipping my table backwards. My head goes down, my feet goes up, and I can feel the woman, the nurse on my left, trying to place an IV. And the nurse on my right is quoting my blood pressure. And I'm lying there. I just feel like I'm falling, like you jumped out of an airplane, just free fall. And I mean, I don't know, you know, that could be, yes, you're dying and the blood pressure is falling. So it creates that sensation. And I remember thinking, what's taking them so long? Because I didn't understand, why can't they get that IV in? It's just fumbling. But as you go into shock, your veins collapse. Mm-hmm. And so now, today, when you go to the ER, they often place an IV and people think, I don't need an IV. Well, you're in the ER and if something goes south and you're going into shock, they have access to your vein. So it's a precaution that they do that. They place an IV. It's just fluids, just water, basically body water, right? But now they have access. So they can inject medications should you, for some reason, go into shock. Well, back then in 1992, I guess they didn't do that. So I'm thinking, what's taking her so long? And the nurse on my right is quoting my blood pressure and she yells, 50 over 15, hurry, like a, you know, loud. And it's shortly after that that I realized I'm dying, which is very different from the experience I had during the birth, where when I was in an airplane that fell out of the sky, you've heard of those, the planes that just fall. I was on one of those too and thought I was going to die. This was very different because I knew that I was dying. And then I got sucked out of my body. And as I got sucked out of my body, my first thought was, wait, how can I still be me and be outside my body? Because this is not supposed to happen. I had no beliefs in this. But then during this first experience there, which is—
And you were like 34 or something when this happened?
Yeah, I was 34.
Yeah, 34.
And this is very different from the second experience where I met spirit guides and it's a whole different, very different. So, but I knew that I had access to all information, past, present, and future. There was no time on the other side, as I called it. I'm on the other side or it's a middle station, right? But there's also that unconditional love and peace. Like for some reason, you're like, wow, I'm outside my body. How can this be? But I belong down there to that body down there. It's almost like I belong in this house. I live in this house, or I belong in my car when I drive my car, but you can just step out of your car, but that's still your car. And it's like that, your soul or your spirit steps outside the body, but you know, I'm going to get back inside soon. Like you get back in your car and you go back home. So it's that kind of feeling. And so, and then, you know, within seconds or a minute or however long I was outside, I get pulled back in and it's just, it happens so fast that you can't really, it's one split second you're inside and the next split second you're outside. You have no idea how you got there or how you got back in. It's just almost instantaneous. This happens so fast. It's like we're not supposed to comprehend it. That's how I look at it. So then I was really sick and lots of things happened, and I had my watches would stop and televisions would turn on. I had a lot of electrical interference, which now I know from all the research that has taken place all over the world of all the people that we resuscitate all the time, that is a common phenomenon that you have these. And I look at it the way, something happens, you step out, you go back in. So your polarities are off or something, you know, your frequencies are somehow off. And so you now interfere with the other frequencies that normally we don't interfere with.
And how long, I mean, this is like a permanent
So my watch stopped, but I was too sick to get another one. It took me 9 months before I could even make it inside like a Caldor or Target to get a watch. And then I wore that for a week and it stopped. And I said, wow, it was so much effort to get this watch. So I made another trip to this store and I returned it and got another watch, the same watch. And I wore it for a week and it stopped. And I brought it back and I said, you know, I don't know, it stopped. And the lady was like, we haven't gotten any other watches back. And I'm like, well, maybe, you know, there is a problem with the quality control or something, because I'm still thinking I'm normal, right? Get another watch, different make, different brand, wear it for a week, it stops. And then I told my friend what had happened and she just started laughing. And she said, honey, it's not you. I mean, it's not the watch, it's you. So at that point I was like, oh, I'm the one who's doing this. And then I would walk by the television, it would turn on, turn it off, walk by again, it would turn on, all these like crazy things. And so if after one
did you bring
year,
somebody with you from the other side?
I was like, what's going on? And then after a year, my watch would tick for a month. After 2 years, it would tick for 2 months. It took me 12 years to have my watch tick for almost exactly 12 months.
Wow.
So it was like every year. When my daughter was three, I had 16 or 17 watches in my bureau, in my drawer. And sometimes, and I would always get a watch with a second hand because it's the only way I knew if it was working. And sometimes they would start working again. So I would say, wow, this one's working. I'll wear this one. And then I would have to look at my watch, you know, to tell time, okay, the second hand is moving. It is 2:45.
Did the doctors notice anything, or did you talk to the doctors about what happened to you? No.
No. So I avoided the doctors like the pest because I was petrified of doctors, because to me, they had many opportunities to treat me or to not make this happen. So I didn't have any trust in doctors. I didn't trust anybody to even come close to me. I would go to the doctor to get the necessary antibiotics and things like that. But what ended up happening is I started getting a lot of bruising, and I bumped into the baby's changing table, something that would give you a bruise the size of a nickel or maybe a dime. And I had a bruise that spanned my entire hip that was purple or red. And then I would keep getting pneumonia. So I had pneumonia in January when the baby was sick. And we went to a walk-in clinic. Everybody had like the flu. I got pneumonia. And then they gave us all antibiotics. And 8 days on antibiotics, everybody's better. The boys were 6 and 4. They were better. The baby was the only one who didn't get it. My husband was better. I get sicker. So I go back to the walk-in clinic and they said, wait, weren't you just here? And I said, yes. And they said, let me take your blood. So they took a blood sample, and then they came back in the room and they said, do you have leukemia or AIDS? Because you have no immune system. So then they said, oh, did you get a blood transfusion? And I said, no, I refused the blood transfusion when I was hemorrhaging to death because of the AIDS epidemic in 1992.
Right.
And they kept me an extra day in the hospital. And they said, you know, you're young, you were otherwise healthy, you're not going to feel too good for a while. And it took, the first 3 months, I pretty much just slept. Until I had enough blood that I could sit up. And then, you know, another 3 months went by and another 3 months went
by. With a new baby.
Yeah. And so we had, my parents were there. My mother-in-law was there. Everybody was coming to take care of the kids. And so it took me 9 months to, you know, to be able to put the kids in the car and drive to my friend's house. That took 10 minutes, and then go lie down on her couch. And then at 11 months, that's when I got the big bruise. Mm-hmm. And again, I got pneumonia, and it's May, and I'm living in Southern California in May. And he sees my big bruise and he's all concerned, you know, it's not right. And I said, well, my husband has a new job and we're on the wait list. We're going to get insurance in July. If I get blood work now, then I'm not going to get insurance because obviously I would have a pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
So he gave me antibiotics and, you know, inhalers and the works. And so that's how it was that whole first year.
And then, you were a stay-at-home mom at this time?
Yeah, I'm a stay-at-home mom. And so, and then the second year, I had my second near-death experience. And so at this point, I'm better, but if I put my knee on the floor to tie my children's shoes, I get a bruise covering my knee. Any kind of light, I would bruise really easily, but it wouldn't span my entire hip. There would be more like a silver dollar size of a bruise. So things had gotten better, but I couldn't stand up to cook for my children. I had a stool in the kitchen, like my 90-year-old something grandmother, because I would get too dizzy if I stood up too long. And I always had this issue of feeling faint or feeling like my soul was leaving, like my soul was separating, just like the feeling I had in the ER during my first near-death experience. I could feel the soul like coming out. And so I was constantly, this is not a good time. We have to stay in the body. You know, I have to be with the children and just like holding on to that. So the question is, you know, is it a emerging problem with the soul nut? Merging completely back into the body, or is it just because you're so sick that you have that sensation? And it reminded me of the ER, right? It's harder to distinguish. Yeah. But the whole point is that I was really sick. And every night, many nights, I couldn't put my head on a pillow because my head would pound too much because I had too little blood in my body. So I had reduction on my platelets, my white blood cells, and my red blood cells. So it's
called, and I think isn't bruising a sign of, you know, hemophiliacs have that.
Yeah.
So,
low platelet. So it's a low platelet count. Mm-hmm. So the way I was bruising, I know that my platelets were really, really low because now that I went to med school, and I learned about what I really had.
But back then you didn't know. Yeah.
I know.
So what was the relationship between, you had mentioned that you didn't get your blood work done. Is there some kind of key? Because it sounded like you didn't get your blood work done. Mm-hmm. Then you became insured with this new job, but you still were having feeling faint for some time after that. So did you get blood work done and it didn't really say anything?
10 years later. 10
wow.
years.
Wow.
So that first year, right after I gave birth, my husband's company was bought. Everybody got laid off. It was a regional manager. And being the sole provider, and now his wife is sick, got three kids at home. He just took like a management job, not a regional manager job, because they don't grow on trees. And so his pay was obviously cut. We couldn't afford the COBRA, which was back then was already like $600 a month in 1992, but for somebody who's in their 30s.
Yeah.
So there was no way we could do that. So I said, well, we'll just wait 3 months. And after 3 months, he found another job. And so now it's Christmas. And then he found another job, and that he started. The last job that he started was like in March. And so, and that's the job he ended up staying with. It was a big corporation. And that's the one that allowed us to get insurance in July. But at this point, I had moved through the worst of that. And so at that point, I would get sick and I would get pneumonia, you know, twice a year. And I go to the doctor and then I just wouldn't do the lab work. They would give me lab work. And I said, you know, they'll say, you're too sick. It's August. Why are you so sick? There's something else that's wrong. We need to do labs. And I was like, okay, thank you. And then I would just not go back to that doctor. And then next time I got sick, I would go to another doctor. Because to me, I knew that I either had leukemia or something bad and they were going to treat me. But at that point, I knew I was getting better, even though I was still sick. But to do some drastic medical intervention. I have heard enough stories from my father growing up and how, as long as my dad's philosophy was always, if you're getting better, don't interfere.
Yes,
so, because
that's so good.
The side effects of all those treatments are horrendous. And now looking back, I'm so glad I didn't have any of the treatments back then.
So there was a real reason you didn't go get that blood work. That's very interesting. So you just went with your intuition.
I trusted my intuition. I trusted that I would heal. And I said, well, I'm getting better. I'm a lot better now than I was a year ago. I was lying down. Now I can, you know, function. Even though I have to sit on a stool when I cook pancakes for the kids, because it takes too long, right? Yeah. I get faint. And but so the second NDE happened.
And NDE is, it, just so my listeners know, NDE is near death experience. So that's mm-hmm. the acronym for it. And it was interesting because let me just, because this, yeah. I just became kind of like, oh, this is interesting. So it sounds like you didn't do anything with your intuition before your first NDE.
No.
You weren't in tune with it at all.
No.
And so
no,
then I mean, you had this. Yeah. So it's like you weren't, it's kind of weird to me because you weren't sharing what you were experiencing with anybody. Mm-hmm. You were just kind of going through it yourself mm-hmm. and navigating everything yourself. And then you started believing and you started paying attention to your mm-hmm. intuition, but it's almost like that was innate. It wasn't anything that you, did you start reading about stuff and researching stuff at that point?
Yeah. So after my first near-death experience, and I told my mother-in-law what had happened, and she explained to me and she said, what you had is called a near-death experience. And she gave me Life After Life by Raymond Moody. And that made me feel not quite as crazy, because I said, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if I'm going crazy. Was that a hallucination? I didn't understand what had happened because my belief system did not match what I had experienced. So I figured, well, either I'm going crazy or something else is going on.
And wasn't Raymond Moody a doctor? I'm trying. I know a doctor went through that and wrote a book.
Yeah. He's written many books and he's very famous in that whole movement. But then I had my second near-death experience. And during the second one, this happened in the middle of the night. And the same thing happens. When I would wake up, so the same thing would happen many nights. I would wake up, my head is pounding. I take my head off the pillow, pull my legs up because it's just getting enough blood in my head. But this night, in the beginning, I had such a hard time. You know, do I call this a spiritually transformative experience or do I call it a near-death experience? But in the end, I mean, the two phrases, spiritually transformative experience or event or a near-death experience, they're very similar. So I call it a near-death experience only because I was walking kind of a fine line between life and death, much more of a fine line than I realized at the time. But now, having gone through med school, I understand how sick I really was at that time. And so it at this point, it doesn't matter what you call it, because it is what happens to you inside of you as a result of the experience that you're having. And that's what's important, and how that transformation comes about. And this is how I ended up going to med school, but we're going to get there. So briefly to tell you the second near-death experience, which is very different from the first one, because I just get pulled out of my body again. It's in split instant. But in this time, I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, which actually is not that common. If you look and start doing research on near-death experience, it's something that we correlate with a near-death experience because of the media and movies and things like that. Oh, it's the tunnel, the light at the end of the tunnel. But most near-death experiences actually don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. So anyway, so I get pulled out of my body. I just tumble through darkness and I end up at this place I call the mid station, because there is a knowing that there's levels, and there are levels above me and there's levels below me. And it's like you're going into a skyscraper and there's 100 floors and you push the button on the 50th floor. You get off at floor 50. You know that there are floors above you in the skyscraper and you know there are floors below you, right? And that is the sensation. Like I am at, and I call it the mid station because it was like I'm in the middle, or the bouncing station because they sent me back. So I get to this place and I hear the most beautiful music.
And was this in your bed at night, or were you in the hospital?
I just got pulled out. All day, you know, several times a day, I have this, my soul is trying to leave.
Yeah.
And I'm holding on to it like I've done, did in the ER during my first near-death experience. And I did every day. I just hold on to that soul. Nope, you got to stay in the body. But this time it was just like split second. I just get pulled out and then I'm just gone.
And were you by yourself in bed? Or
nope, my husband was asleep next to me.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, you always wonder like you know, was this 5 seconds or was it 5 minutes? You know, because yeah. there's no time on the other side. You have no concept of the time that this happened.
If only you had a Fitbit, because that would record. Although it might not work on you.
Right. So it's like, yeah, yeah. it's just it's because your body is still, you know, it's like the soul is separating, right? But the body is still there. It's like people who have near-death experiences in a coma, like Eben Alexander, for example, who was a brain surgeon at Harvard, who had a E. coli meningitis, had a 2% chance of survival, and he was in a coma. And they did brain studies on him, and there was nothing registered. And he was at Harvard. He's a brain surgeon, and he had this whole experience on the other side. So anyway, so this is what happens to people. So you don't have to be actually dead to have a near-death experience. It's just the separation of the soul goes on a soul journey. Mm. So anyway, so I hear this most beautiful music, and I look in one cabin. So I see two log cabins. And I open the door on one and I look inside and I figured the music must be coming from there. And it's just empty. So then I see another one and I open the door to that one and it's just empty. So then I become aware of this growing light behind me. And as I'm turning around without my body, it's just like you're just this soul entity. I turn around and it's like standing in a spotlight at a dealership, right? It's just the bright white light is just everywhere and it just sort of envelopes you.
I'm thinking of the movie Sing too, because they had they had them on stage with my grandson loves that movie. So yeah.
Yeah. But the music is coming from the light and the music is coming from the angel. So there is an outline of angels in the white light and the music is coming from the angels.
Oh.
And I didn't believe in angels. So why am I seeing music coming from the angels when I don't even believe in it? I'm still trying to process my first near-death experience, which I thought was just some form of a hallucination. And now I'm hearing the most beautiful music and it's coming from angels from this beautiful light. But this light is just unconditional love. And there is this understanding that you come from the light and you return to the light, you carry this light within you.
Mm.
So, and then there's two spirit guides that show up and the one on my right.
Oh, we got a doggy. If you're on YouTube, you got to see her Labradoodle. How cute.
Well, hello. Did you escape? Yes. You escaped. I heard you. So there is two spirit guides and the one on my right says to the other spirit guide, what is she doing here? She can't be here. She has to go back. And, you know, I say, wait a second. I'm like, how can I still be me and be outside my body? And the spirit guide on the left says, well, if I told you, you wouldn't remember. And then it's like I'm standing on the moon and I'm looking down on the earth, but around the earth, there is this silvery, glittery fishnet, as I call it. Now you can Google these images on Google and you can Google grid around the earth and you can see what I saw. But this is 1992, so we did not have Google back then. And I searched the San Francisco Public Library for any information on what I had seen, could not find anything. So anyway, so I see this grid around the earth and the spirit guide says, everything on earth is connected to each other, but everything on earth is connected up to this grid. And with that information, I got sent back. And it's that information that, you know, happened now, what, 28 years ago, that was that near-death experience, that it still was propelling my work today, because I end my book, my Med School After Menopause, The Journey of My Soul. It ends with, we are all connected. We are all one. It is all divine. And so are you. Because we are so delicately intertwined to each other, to our past lives, to our ancestors, and everything that we say, do, and act are connected. And that is what's propelling my work today as a physician and an ancestral healer, is the understanding of that and how to treat that. So let me ask you this,
before we move on, and that, this is all fascinating to me. So, but the question I have, which some of my listeners might have, is what is the difference why do you call what most people would think, who hadn't had a previous near-death experience, mm-hmm. a dream mm-hmm. versus a near, like, how do you know? I mean, because it was so vivid. I mean, I've had mm-hmm. dreams where it's vivid. And I, honestly, I feel that when you go to sleep, mm-hmm. your spirit can actually leave your body. I mean, I yeah. think that's like, I think you go and visit with mm-hmm. your spirit, mm-hmm. your angel guides and yeah. all that when mm-hmm. you go to sleep. So is there a distinction or it, you know, is
it yeah, because I was awake when it happened. So I wasn't dreaming. So I was awake. I'm trying to take my head. Yeah, I took my head off the pillow. Like I'm doing the normal things like that would always happen. And I'm just like, I'm too faint. I can't pass out. You know, put more blood in my head, move my head off the pillow. And then that's it. I'm being sucked out of my body. So
it's different
if you're asleep and you could have a dream and your soul is journeying, right? Yeah. You might see things. Go places. I've done that in my dreams. I've gone to places and then described the area I was in. And then voila, you know, 2 months later, there I am. And oh, look at that. Look, I wrote this. Thank God I wrote this down in my book, or thank God I told somebody about this dream, because otherwise I wouldn't have confirmation. And then I would think it was just a deja vu. So,
yes. So when you came back, were mm-hmm. you still sitting up?
Or no, I was still lying down. I was lying in my bed.
So you were awake, but you were lying down. Okay.
Yeah. And then my daughter woke up and started crying literally, you know, like 30 seconds or a minute after I came back into my body. And I just said, this is why they sent me back, because I have to be here. They knew she was waking up
And so when was this? Was this?
That was 1994.
Okay. So a couple of years after your other one.
Yeah. So 2 years later.
Yeah. And so then were you really fascinated? Is that kind of what led you, not only because you originally, that was what you should have done mm-hmm. to follow your heart, but the fact that you wanted to kind of dig deeper on how medicine.
So what happened next is, so for the next 10 years, so I had already started here in the spirit world. That started right the day after my first near-death experience, when I was in the hospital and I had hemorrhaged to death in the ER. My sister-in-law had just passed away 10 days earlier. And as I'm lying in that hospital bed, I become aware of my sister-in-law in the left corner of the ceiling. And I can hear her say, everything is going to be okay. Because I was still, you know, oh my gosh, like, am I going to survive this? And what happened yesterday? Am I going crazy now? I can't tell anyone. They're going to lock me up in the mental ward, you know, in the hospital. I'll never see my kids again. I was petrified.
So this is after your near-death experience.
Yep. I started hearing the spirit world. And then, you know, as time went on, so then this was before the second one, had my uncle passed away. And so this was a year after my first near-death experience, in between the two near-death experiences. And my uncle had lung cancer, and I had no idea. I don't think anybody really knew how long he had left to live. And I certainly didn't, because I lived in the United States and my family's in Sweden. And one night I woke up and I didn't see him. I was aware of the fact that it was my uncle. And he came and he said, I have passed to the other side and I'm just, you know, checking up on you and saying goodbye. And I figured my mom was going to call me the next day because it was my mom's brother. And she had two siblings, one brother, one sister. And I figured she would call me from Sweden and tell me that he had passed away, but she didn't call. And I said, wow, that's so weird. And then another day went by, no call. Third day, finally, my mom calls and she does the usual check-in. How are the kids? How is everything? Right? Like a good mom. And then finally she said, well, I have something sad to tell you. And I said, yes, my uncle, your brother passed away on Monday, or, you know, 2 days ago. And it was just dead silence on the other side. And she said, how did you know? And I said, he was here. He told me. Mm-hmm. And so that communication with the spirit world started, you know, literally right after my first NDE. And then it just became more and more and more as time went on. So for the next 12 years, I would know things about people. I would know this person is sick, a relative, this person has to go back to the hospital. This person is going to die. We're going to be in an accident. You two of my kids are going to be in the car. This is what the scratch looks like on the car. And it, like all these different things, I would just see it and hear it. And that went on for 12 years. So after 12 years, I'm a slow learner. So I'm like, give me proof. Let me see that again. And I learned to start writing things down, because in the beginning, when I would have moments saying, oh my gosh, this is really happening, is this a deja vu, or is it, did I really have this premonition last week? So I started writing things down in a book, or I would tell my husband, or I would tell my kids, you know, what I had seen or experienced, because it was the only way I would know that it was, you know, messages from the spirit world. So after 12 years of this, the spirit world basically dropped in on me and told me I had to go to med school and become a physician. And I was to write two books. No, wait, three was the message. And I was to combine East and West, old and new, bring messages and healing to the people. And I just looked at, you know, what do you mean writing a book? I'm not an author. What do you mean, like, healing people? And the message was so clear. And they said, no, you have the first thing you have to do, focus on becoming a doctor, because that is the first thing you have to do. And I enrolled in those pre-med classes literally within a week. So, you know, can you transform your life when you're in your, I was probably in my mid to late 40s at the time, because it took a good 6 years to do. I had to do Chem 1, Chem 2, OChem 1, OChem 2, Biology 1, Biology 2, Physics and Math. I was a business major as an undergraduate, so I had no science classes. Ah. I had to take high school advanced placement biology before I could take the freshman biology class, because I didn't have any of it. So,
and what did your husband think?
Oh, he just said, "Oh, you should be a doctor." We always knew she should be a doctor.
Well, good for him being so supportive.
It's never too late, right? Yeah. It's never too late to transform your life. And I think when I first stumbled upon the degree, I said, "This is a real medical school. I can't do that. What am I, crazy? I go through all these prereq classes, and then there's no guarantee they're going to accept me. There's no guarantee I'm even going to be able to handle that kind of a course load. Will I ever graduate? You know, maybe it's just too much." And I walked away from my computer, and that's when the spirit world said, "Nope, this is what you have to do." And I said, "Aye, aye, captain," and off I went. So, but do you have to have that experience to follow your calling in life? No.
I was going to ask you, do you think you always had it, or do you think that because of what changed, you know, electrically, because there's electrical changes that happened, do you think that kind of turned something on?
No, I think it was always there. It was just, I had to have these experiences to become the person I am today. I truly think we incarnate for our life. I took that ticket in the spirit world. I said, you know, ticket 363, please. I'll do that one this time. Uh-huh. And you go through,
what's 363? Did I miss something?
No. I'm just making it up. Like, I took that ticket. Like, okay. Like, you're at a meat counter at the grocery store. Like, you have your ticket, and that's what I signed up for in this life, to have my soul.
But does that ticket have, like, you know, a route?
Yeah, I think it has, you know, it has your major route. I think that we incarnate to have certain experiences, and then we have free will intermixed with that. But ultimately, maybe you have, you know, there are five ways for you to get this experience. You can either hemorrhage during childbirth, or if that doesn't work, you can do the car accident. Or if that doesn't work, you can do, you know, saying, but ultimately it's going to lead you on that path. It's going to put you on that path for your transformational work during your life.
Yeah.
And when you're in the slump, you know, your life is like a roller coaster. Sometimes you're on top of that mountain and everything is great, and then, you know, that car goes down and you're down in the valley. And the thing is that nothing lasts forever, right? And so when I was sick, it literally took me, you know, a good 6 years to get out of, you know, being able to walk through a grocery store without feeling like I was going to pass out. But with that also came the transformation. So I became clairvoyant, clairaudient, and clairsentient, and claircognizant. And I started hearing things, seeing things, feeling things in my body.
I've heard of clairvoyant, but I hadn't heard of it as audient and sentient.
Yeah. So I hear things, I see things, I feel things. So many times when I work as a medical intuitive, I split my time working as a physician and working spiritually with people. Mm. And it's so interesting because I feel it, you know, I feel it in my body. And I worked with someone last week, And I said, it's in your chest region. I would say it's your breasts. And, but then if I go down to my abdomen, I feel like this toxic effect. And you either had chemotherapy for breast cancer, or you're taking a drug, you either had it, because there's this toxic effect that causing upsets with your digestive system. So many times I feel the density. The same thing when I work with the spirit world. Sometimes I will understand exactly how they passed away, and I'll say, your mom had, you know, ovarian cancer, because I feel it in my ovaries. Mm-hmm. Or and I know where the organs are, so I know which organ it is, right? So it's very interesting. But mm-hmm. it's the combination of having the medical knowledge from being a physician and then also being a medium, you know, or a psychic medium. Evidential psychic medium is the correct name, because you have to provide evidence that who you're speaking to. Mm-hmm. But it's become a very interesting combination of having the medical knowledge, but also working intuitively or mediumistically, because I really work with my spirit guides. I believe it's more my spirit guides that give me the feeling, because it's the same. When I work with the spirit world, I get the feeling in my body how they passed, or something happened, or this person was very sad, or they had a really hard, depressing life, or, you know, you can feel it. Or this person was really, you know, charming and outgoing, and he's vibrant, and he's funny, and he keeps making jokes, right? Yeah. And so you get the feeling in your body of what that is, what the disease is, or who the personality is, if you're working mediumistically. But all that came about from my near-death experiences. But I think it was always there, right? So when I've trained with, you know, world-famous shamans and worked at my teachers at Arthur Findlay College, they've told me, no, you had this when you were a child. Now think back, because they, you know, they're getting their messages. And then I'd say, oh yeah, now I remember. Yeah, I remember seeing colors around my dad. Oh yeah, I remember this. I remember that. But growing up being, you know, the scientist that I was, and my dad not believing in anything, he's like, no, religion is just, you know, that's just a made up story, because he was raised with it and he didn't believe in it. So then I was raised that way, right? Yeah. And so if you can't prove it, it doesn't exist. That's how I was raised.
Yeah. So do you think everybody has it, or do you think some people, because we were talking before about mm-hmm. numerology and how, like, and astrology, and how there, you know, you have different personalities and personality mm-hmm. types, and each type has their own specialty of mm-hmm. how they are meant to walk in the world. So mm-hmm. do you think though everybody has that, or because you're a healer, you said that's kind mm-hmm. of what mm-hmm. your life path.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that everybody has it. Mm-hmm. And I talk a lot about it in my book. So it's called Med School After Menopause, because it's meant, that's the title the spirit world gave me, The Journey of My Soul. And it's meant to inspire particularly women, but the men that have read my book, they love it too. But life doesn't end because you're going through menopause, or because your children grew up and now you're in your 50s. Because when you're looking at your life, you weren't an adult until you were 21, and now you're 50. So that was only 30 years as an adult. Now, what are you going to do next 30 years?
I know.
Play golf or sit in a rocking chair for the next 30 years.
Think we count those first 20 years, and we didn't really do anything those first 20
right?
years.
Right. Yeah. The 30 years, if you raised kids, I mean, you did all of that. Now you have, now is this a new section of your life when you have the ability to follow your own heart and your own passion, especially if you have been home and maybe just been home raising kids. And now is your chance to follow your own path and find what you truly resonate with. And so in my book, I talk in more in detail about my near-death experiences and all the different clairvoyant events, but it's to help other people tune into that intuition, because everybody has intuition. We are all spiritual beings. We can all connect with the spirit world. It's just a matter of allowing it to happen, because we all have it. We are spiritual creatures. We all interact and feel things. Everybody, you know, if you walk into a room and let's say five people are in this room and they just had a big argument, and you walk into the room and you're just happy, and you walk in and all of a sudden you're like, wow, whew, kind of a, you know, static air in here. And it's very tense. You can feel that the argument has, you know, been going down. So everybody can tune into this, right? Or if you meet somebody and you just, oh, that person is so wonderful, I'm so attracted to that person, he's such a sweetheart, right? You resonate, you don't even have to say much, like, hello, how are you? And you just tune into that, you feel the energy of that person. And, you know, these are things, whether you're empathic or not empathic, most people can tune into whether somebody's in a really bad mood or somebody's in a really good mood, right?
Yeah, and I would love to say, because I'm a big believer that busyness really blocks a lot of that. And so we live in such a busy world and we can't turn things off. You know, it's technology, it's our schedules, it's, and, you know, a lot of people that are my age who we're moms. And, you know, I juggled all the things, right? Being a mom, working a corporate job, and then taking care of a husband, you know, because so I had to do all the things. I remember when I was home with the kids for just a very short time, because I wasn't making enough money. So I said to my ex-husband, I said, well, I'll just stay home for, and I'll bring kids in and I'll watch some kids because I'm not making enough money. And it breaks my heart to have to take them and hand them off to somebody. So I did that. But then when it's time for me to, they can go now to preschool, time for me to go back to work, I was still expected to do the laundry, do the cooking, do the everything. And I was like, you know, there was a book that really helped me, and I was trying to find it recently. I'm pretty sure it was called Superwoman, but it was talking about like what the woman of the age that I was in that, you know, 80s, it was late 80s. Yeah. And I was basically expected to do everything and we were the generation where like our parents, my mom worked, but a lot of her peers didn't work.
Yeah.
And so, but my generation was like expected to do it all. And so that book really helped me. And it really helped me put boundaries in that said, okay, we're hiring a cleaning person. Right. You know? I do not spend my time free cleaning.
I think I went through the same thing. Yes.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that book. I also hired a cleaning lady at that point, because you can't, like you say, we were expected to do all of it. There was no division of labor. With our generation, we were just expected to be super moms, to raise the kids, do all the grocery shopping, cook all the meals, do all the cleaning, and go to work. And do everything. And that was just, I think, common with our generation.
And my job, you know, it was a high stress corporate job too. And it wasn't anything that just like, I had to use my mind. And when I got home, I just like, like the man come home and kick his feet up and relax, you know, I wanted to do that too, but I couldn't. When you say, when somebody walks in the room and there's been a fight and you're just like in tune and you can, like, I think sometimes people, like, they come into a room and they're just not paying attention. They're not listening and they're busy talking, you know? And so, I think that is how a lot of us live. I know I lived like that. And the quieter I get, the more I hear.
Yeah. Right. So the tune into the spirit world, the best thing you can do is just create silence for yourself, meditate, whether it's with music or not music, or, you know, if you can't meditate in the beginning, it's something you kind of get used to, you know, go for a walk in nature for 20 or 30 minutes, just to tune out or tune away from our busy lives.
Yeah.
Our cell phones and computers. And it's just, it's like we're on an electronic leash all day long.
Yeah. You mentioned that you started writing things down. So is that something that you, like when you would wake up from a dream, you'd write it down, or when you had a thought, you'd write it down? Or like, did you have any sort of a practice that was like, I am going to make myself sit down every day and write down what comes up in my head?
Yeah. I would just write in the beginning. I would just write it in a notebook. You know, if I had a dream, I would just write it down. Because, you know, there are certain dreams that just seem really real and you're like, wow, where is this place? And then sometimes you know where it is, but you know, also know that the building doesn't exist. But if you write it down, then you can go back and say, oh yeah, it's not a deja vu because it did happen. I did see this, whether it's in a dream or you had, you know, just a thought that came in from somewhere that told you something. You know, write it down, because then when it happens or you have that experience later on, and it might be a week later or it might be 6 months later, right? It could be a year later, you can go back. Oh my gosh, there it is. I did write it down. Yes, this is exactly what's happening.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I often will have these really vivid dreams, like at 3 o'clock or so in the morning. And then I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh my God. And I'll like the detail will be incredible. And they're like, I'm going to have to write that down when I get up in the morning. And then I wake up in the morning and it's gone.
Yes, you have to write it down when you wake up, like that moment.
Yeah.
Because many times you wake up and then you lose it very quickly. So you have to just grab your pen or pen and paper and start writing right away.
And it's such an important message too, usually.
Keep that book next to your bed.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if you wake up and if you sleep next to someone who is, you know, if you turn on the light, have your little book light, you know, that's already on the book. So you can just click and then write it down quickly.
Yeah. I have one next to my bed. So yeah.
Right. Or go to the bathroom.
Or the other thing you can do is because the voice notes are really good. So you can speak into your phone, you know, but maybe you step out of the room. So
But it's a good way of taking notes. I would often write down things on my phone. Yeah.
That's
you know, if you're out and about or something and you're having this epiphany or, you know, then you can write it down.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many funny, things just happen. I think the more you listen, the more things happen. And there's so many stories. One story that just came to mind was I was living up in 2 hours north of Phoenix after I graduated. I was doing my residency up there and I was going down to Phoenix. And I was grabbing my purse off the counter and I heard the spirit world say, watch out for the red truck. And I saw an image at the same time. And I saw this red truck swerving out into the left lane and then back into the right lane. And I knew that it was on the 17 going down, like from Flagstaff going south down into Phoenix, because I could see the mountains in the background. So at first I drove, you know, half an hour to get to the 17 and then I get on there. And there's so many trucks because they're hauled between Phoenix, Tucson, Flagstaff, right? Up and down Arizona, you know, white truck, black truck, you know, and all of a sudden I'm in the left lane and I'm paying attention. It's a red truck. So I'm like, oh my gosh, there's the red truck. That was my warning. So I stay behind the truck and there is a car that's passing the truck. And you know how it is on the freeway? The speed limit is, you know, 65. Everybody's going 70, 75 in the left lane, right? So I'm behind this other car, but instead of following him closely, like, you know, you just stay in your driving pattern on the freeway. I stay behind the truck because I'm aware of that warning. And I wait for him to pass the truck all the way and give me enough room to pass the truck to get behind him on the other side. So I stay behind the truck. I wait for him to pass. He just cleared the truck. So now he's in front, but I'm waiting because I need more space. And there's also a railing on the left. So if the truck swerves, I have nowhere to go. So I'm waiting. I'm staying behind the truck, waiting for the railing to end, waiting for the truck to get ahead of me enough that I know I can, if he swerves, I would have space to go out on the shoulder and then come back in. So I'm staying behind the truck and then the car clears in front of me. The red truck, what does it do? It completely swerves out into the left lane and then back into the right lane. And I don't know if he was texting or what he was doing, but it was just one big swerve and he corrects the truck. I mean, at that point, I literally just like screamed that in my car. Thank you, spirit world. You know, because literally they saved my life. If I had been passing him, I would just have gotten pushed off the freeway.
Yeah. So, and did you hesitate because of that vision you had seen?
Yeah, I knew I had to listen because the spirit world has not been wrong. They're never wrong. And I've learned to listen to these messages because as many times in the beginning, you think, oh, it's just a deja vu. But, you know, after now it's been, you know, that was probably 20 years out. Right. Yeah. And so I trust when I get a message like that, I'm going to listen because it's a
crazy
warning. But many times, you know, I think, you know, many people get warning signs like that. When you start talking about it, people will say, oh yeah, I remember once I heard this voice say, you know, take the surface streets, don't go on the highway. And then there was an accident. Right.
Yeah.
I think most of us get messages honestly all the time, but it's just a matter of whether we're listening to it and we're discounting them saying,
yes, we dismiss that was just so much
like a deja vu or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you just tune in, the more you tune in, the more messages you will get.
Right. And that not is just like things that could bad that could happen to you, but it's things good that could happen to you. It's like, what are you supposed to be doing instead of what you're doing now? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen to the heart.
Yes.
I tell people, like, don't listen to your brain. The brain is going to reason you out of the things, but it's the more you still your mind and the more quiet you become, the more you tune into your heart space and the more you will learn to resonate with what it is that actually makes you tick.
Yeah.
Versus what your brain logically says what you should be doing, right? Logically, my brain said, don't go to med school. That's crazy. You're in your 40s. There's no guarantee of anything. And then the spirit world said, you got to go.
Yeah.
And I mean, even when getting to medical school, I said, this was a mistake. What am I doing here?
Yeah. I've told this story before, but I just want to tell it again because it's so appropriate for this topic is that my heart always, I loved my husband I'm married to now, and I loved him from like really the first time I saw him on the rugby field. But we dated for a couple of years in college, and we broke up. My heart never really recovered from it. Right. Mm-hmm. I married somebody else because my logic brain was like, oh, if you marry him, if you married the guy that you dated in college, if you married him, you'd fight all the time and you'd end up divorcing because it's just like, but it was passionate. It was so passionate. Right. Mm-hmm. And we were just both young and very kind of set in our ways. Over time, I think that would have worked out maybe, but anyway, so I married somebody else and for a long time, I didn't think about him. It wasn't like I spent every waking day thinking about him. But I periodically, he would come back up my head and I'd be like, I wonder what he's doing. Oh, you know, and I had a box I never threw away. And finally, one day at my 35th reunion, somebody brought his name up and my ex-husband and I were not really, we weren't even living in the same town at that point where he was kind of commuting away. We'd been struggling for a while. And so, I just kept thinking about him and I was like, my heart, I'm going to not deny my heart. I'm going to I'm going to follow this through and just see, I'm just going to see. And it's going to be hard because I'm going to have to make some tough decisions about my life. I'm going to trust that it's going to work out no matter what, it's going to work out. And here we've been married 13 years and it's never been like a question, like from the minute, like we talked on the phone to having, you know, lunch and meeting for lunch and then just like starting up. There was never he was a bachelor. He never got married. Right. So there was a little bit of a breaking in period. Mm-hmm. But it's been the easiest marriage. So easy. Yeah. And so it's like, who knows what would have happened if I followed my heart then, but I wasn't going to not follow my heart for my whole life. I was like, it's time to start listening and stop ignoring. So anyways, I know we could talk I think it's been an hour. So that's so long. I knew it was going to happen because there's just so much juicy stuff and you had those stories to tell, but I would love for you to come back. Could we record another time and talk about, because one of the things that you are very knowledgeable about is ancestral healing. And I think that's so fascinating. And so, you are the creator of healing your ancestral mother wound. And I think a lot of people could really, if they dug into that, it would free them from a lot of emotional pain that they're going through. I mean, there's a lot of baggage that we are still carrying at this late stage in life, and we can unload that.
Ancestral healing is an hour topic in itself.
So
we can definitely do that. It is incredibly healing once you start understanding how interconnected we are to our ancestors. And whether you like it or not, you're carrying 50% of the mom's DNA and 50% of dad's DNA. And just to set that up for ancestral healing topic in the future, we now know that we actually inherit trauma via DNA. So I'm going to leave it at that. But
yeah,
so we inherit trauma. So your grandfather's trauma might have been passed down to you, and you may have experiences in your life that could be, for example, anxiety about something. And it is because of the traumatic experiences of your grandfather, who may have served in World War II, for example, right? And you got war experiences and things like that, or just other traumatic experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's anything that is unhealed in past events of your ancestors that actually can get passed down on your DNA. Mm. And also, of course, emotionally and spiritually and through the energetic grid and everything else. But it's fascinating that for the people that are listening that are just, you know, scientists and are maybe getting into this more spiritual thinking of things, just know that it actually gets transferred on DNA.
Mm.
So it's fascinating. Yeah, it's fascinating so cool. Work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what last thought, tip, you know, any kind of anything from your spirit guides that you want to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, I would say, so it's never too late to, you know, to transform your life or to change your life. If you're in one of those pickles right now and feeling stuck, know that it's temporary. And nothing lasts forever, because everything is energy, and energy is, you know, not created, not stored. It's just constantly evolving and moving. And just know that it's just a matter of changing your perception. I talk a lot about this in ancestral healing, changing your perception of how you view your problem. Once you can see that those issues from a different angle, you can also create healing for that. And then your life transforms. Mm. And so know that it's never too late to change your path, to try something new. You're never too old to go back to school. It's actually a benefit of being older, going back to school, because you have all that life experience under your belt.
Yes. Yes.
So don't be afraid of trying something new and going in a new direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that, because we have so much wisdom that we can use, and mm-hmm. we think we have to have some kind of certificate, but mm-hmm. we have so much that, you know, life experience, lived experience. So
yeah,
thank you so much. It was so interesting. All right. And I'll have you back, and maybe we'll get together when I'm in Phoenix soon.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Not Your Average Lives podcast. If you haven't yet, make sure to subscribe on iTunes if you have an Apple device. You can find free resources and learn what else I have going on at the moment that might interest you on my website at notyouraveragegrandma.com. You can also find me on Instagram or Facebook at Not Your Average Grandma. If you liked this episode, it would make my heart so happy if you could leave me a 5-star rating. You can also add a review to let me know what you like about this podcast, which will help spread the word about it to others who need a little midlife inspiration. As always, be you, listen to your inner voice, and focus on reigniting that lost spark so you can start living your own, not your average, life.